Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. We're going to have a new philosophy course this fall called Knowledge, Evidence, and Justification. It's a 4,800-level course that will take place on Wednesdays from 4:30 to 7:30 in room 202 of the James Union Building, and the teacher is Dr. Clarence S. Johnson, a professor of philosophy here at MTSU. We're going to talk about the types of things that are going to be discussed in the course. What is knowledge? How do you justify what you're arguing? And not only from a philosophical point of view, but the practical applications as well. Dr. Johnson, thanks for being with us here today.
Pleasure.
How do you define knowledge?
Wow, that's a very difficult question. In fact, the whole course is about that. Perhaps a better way of approaching it is to say, why this quest for knowledge? When people talk about knowledge, one first claim that one is making is that knowledge entails truth, the truth of a proposition. In fact, there are different kinds of knowledge you can talk about. So the kind of knowledge we are interested in this course is what is called propositional knowledge. But the other kinds of knowledge are acquaintance, knowledge by acquaintance. I'm acquainted with my feelings, if you will. There is also the competent sense. I know how to go about finding my way across campus. I know how to go about locating material in the library. And then there is the propositional sense. I know that such and such is the case. Now, it is this third sense of knowledge that is the problematic one. Because when you say, I know that P, standing for some proposition, P must be true. Mm-hmm. It's a contradiction in terms to talk about false knowledge. So it's not just that P must be true, but some would even argue that you must have the right to be sure of P.
Yeah.
And then, because the reason that you must have the right to be sure is that when you make a knowledge claim, you're putting yourself in a position of authority to vouch for the truth of what you claim to know, because we want to rule out accidents.
Right.
We don't say you stumble upon the truth. You should know exactly what it is. And in this kind of a context, therefore, we're looking for evidence. What justifies the claim to knowledge itself? That's where evidence comes in.
Right.
And the relevant kind of evidence. And so we try to rule out certain kinds of things. And when we're making this kind of an evaluation, because when you say you know something and basically you're making a normative claim, we want to be able to see, in fact, if you are justified in making that kind of a claim.
But so because different people have different life experiences, different people have different concepts of what the truth is based on their knowledge. Like, say, a Gilded Age robber baron might believe based on his knowledge that life is good, and a 21st century homeless man might believe that life is bad based on his knowledge.
Experiencing that kind of a situation, yes, no question about it. Well, we want to be able to ascertain the truth of the proposition itself. And when we begin to do that, we look at the kind of evidence you bring to bear upon the claim. Is it the kind that is really relevant to the claim you are making? If it is, then perhaps we want to say, yeah, you're justified in fact in believing us. But we also would want to look at the extent or the scope of the evidence. Because what happens if perhaps you merely focus on some aspects of life, but you ignore a whole significant aspect of life, and then you end up believing as you do that life sucks, as it were, or question then becomes, well, are you justified in making that, in holding that belief? You've discounted a significant portion of life experience. So we'd want to say, well, subjectively, perhaps we can say, well, you have a basis for your belief, but objectively, that is because you have failed to take into account so many other kinds of considerations that should be relevant in making your assessment, objectively, your claim cannot be true at all, cannot be justified. This is unreliable.
A great premium is placed on empirical data, quantitative analysis in finding justification for the decisions that people make. There's an old saw that figures lie and liars figure, and statistics can be manipulated and spun and twisted in order to prove one particular thesis or another.
Right.
So where does that figure into the equation?
Well, from the empirical point of view, the thing is, well, there are different kinds of knowledge, okay? And empirically, we want to be able to say, well, certain kinds of experiences are really relevant, so we would make an assessment of those. And if they are really relevant, then they should uphold the facts, the truth to this. And so we can say, okay, in this case, it worked. What if you involve empirical data, but that are not relevant, which is quite possible?
Right.
Then, of course, we're going to discount that.
Yeah.
And in the case of statistics, people say, well, numbers, you can do anything with numbers whatsoever that you're doing. Okay, and that is so true. And statistics don't tell it all, basically. And when we look at numbers, we do not verify or falsify claims about mathematics by consulting experience. We can apply mathematics to experience. Some people would say, and that's where a distinction comes in between a priori knowledge and empirical knowledge or posteriori knowledge. If somebody were to say that it is knowing in Timbuktu, the only basis for that claim would have to be experience. If we want to verify or falsify it, we consult experience. Mm. But if somebody were to say a triangle has three angles, well, of course, that's by definition. So it could not conceivably be otherwise because it's true by definition. So that's an a priori I claim.
Yeah.
So if one takes mathematics, for example, one can engage mathematics purely and simply from the a priori point of because we're simply doing analysis there. Okay. And can we apply math? Of course we can. And can we conceive of things which we have not experienced? Of course. Concept of a kilogram, 1,000-sided. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen one. Nobody actually can. But by definition, we know that a kilogram is 1,000-sided. So those are two different kinds of claims that one can make. So, and an individual actually could know mathematics, okay, in that sense of the word, because he or she is equipped with the capacity to do math quite well. But completely, when you look at her empirical claims or his empirical claims, many of them perhaps are false. So there are different kinds of ways of, in fact, assessing those claims. Now, I don't know. I'm not a statistician or a mathematician, but people actually can manipulate, as you rightly pointed out, mathematics or statistics to do any kind of thing they want. What is going on, however, the kind of claim they want to validate or justify or invalidate, as the case may be, the claim itself is going to be some kind of a factual claim. And so we can address the facts that are being invoked by these individuals by seeing if indeed the facts are as they have described them, the facts are as they have tried to make them appear using statistics. So we resort to the empirical method.
A great many times someone will be trying to explain their position and they will say, I don't have any facts and figures, but such and such happened to so and so, and what they say will be dismissed as, well, that's just anecdotal. But a great many times, especially through the mass media, using an anecdote in order to convey information about a very complicated subject is the methodology that has to be used in order to appeal to all different kinds of people of all different kinds of education levels, not only, you know, make it understandable to them, but also get them interested in it so that they will attempt to understand it. Mm-hmm. How problematic is this when it comes to justifying and presenting evidence for something?
Using anecdotal information?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, if the anecdotal piece of information itself is true, you can draw upon it to the extent that it is pertinent to what you want to establish. One cannot discount it. As such, if it can be verified, you can establish independently that indeed what you're saying is the case. Then you can draw upon it because knowledge claims are not made in isolation at all. Some people would say, in fact, many of the propositions we are formulating, they are not independent. They always fit into some kind of a system. So, in fact, for a proposition to be intelligible, there is a whole series of background beliefs which that proposition actually would have to fit to, and these background beliefs themselves would support the truth of that proposition. So, if these background beliefs actually are inconsistent with the proposition, then, of course, you know that it cannot be sustained at all. It is false. So, anecdotal information is relevant to the extent that fits into, it enables us, it illuminates a particular point of view, what we are trying to establish. We can determine relevance that, and we know when propositions are relevant and when they are irrelevant. And some people would even say, look, common sense tells us we can rely on common sense. We cannot go on just doubting and doubting and doubting. At some point, we have to assume that there is a starting point, which itself, some people would say, well, they call them basic propositions, some kinds of claims that we've got to accept as true, and on the basis of which we build other kinds of claims. So yes, the anecdotal links sometimes have to be able to assess these propositions themselves. That they support.
In your class, when you discuss knowledge, evidence, and justification, how do you take into account that different forms of argumentation are required for different kinds of formats? For example, you wouldn't apply the same types and methodologies of argumentation to a college debate competition that you would to a life or death murder trial in the American justice system, and you can go on and on about rules of evidence and all of that sort mm-hmm. of thing. There's no one-size-fits-all for this set of guidance for this type of thing, is there?
Well, yes and no. I say yes and no because let's begin with the no component. Argumentation, when we're involved in argumentation or engage in argumentation, organization, we are trying to establish and avoid falsity. So there are rules of argumentation, there are principles of argumentation that follow. So a basic class in logic, that's precisely why a basic class in logic is geared toward a whole body of students of different backgrounds, because simply following the principles of rational thought, if you will. And so there are good forms of reasoning and bad forms. So whether you're doing science or you're doing philosophy or you're doing literature, whatever form of reasoning you're going to be employing has to follow certain kinds of rules, and those rules are basically the same. So everybody has that kind of a capacity to understand those. And another way of putting it is to say, even when we make use of language, language is rule governed. So it makes no difference what language you're using, whether it be French or English or German or Swahili. Mm-hmm. There are rules here, so the rules themselves do not change at all. So if that is the case, then when we engage in and we're looking at different kinds of argumentation in different domains, whether it's law or in debates, etc., one of the things we try to avoid is inconsistency. A basic principle of logic is consistency. So the moment somebody contradicts himself or makes inconsistent claims, whether in empirical research or in pure argumentation or in interpreting a literary work, we'll say your claim cannot be sustained at all. So yes, now what you're asking then, if one is looking at the fact, say if you are a historian too, because historians do debate, okay, they do argue, but then we're looking at the kind of fact the historian is going to adduce to uphold his or her thesis, because she wants to make the case or he wants to make the case that this was the proximate cause of World War II. For example, another historian might say, no, the proximate cause of World War II was this. So the whole contrary thesis is there, but each one of them is going to adduce evidence to show that his or her thesis is the correct one. And the evidence that he or she is going to adduce will be factual claims that she is going to invoke. But one thing is clear, even though they hold contrary positions, they are basically upholding the principles of argumentation. And each one of them is trying to avoid inconsistency. Each one of them is trying to avoid any kind of a contradiction. Each one of them is trying to say, look, my claim is not only true, but indeed I can give you a rationale for why I believe what I do believe as to why this is so. In terms of the nature of the evidence itself, you look at different kinds of facts depending on the discipline.
Right.
But in terms of argumentation itself, in and of itself, we are all actually following the same principles. That's why logic is such a vital tool. And one of the disappointments we've had here at MTSU, my department, is that MTSU has not made logic a requirement for all of the majors, the basic principle of what we, which I know other institutions actually have it for all of the undergraduate. It is a must.
It is a necessity for critical thinking in all kinds of disciplines, not just philosophy itself, if one is a philosophy major, but it's applicable to math, it's applicable to journalism, it's applicable to science.
Exactly. I mean, that has been the case. In fact, one of the things we have done, it's the foundation of math. And prior to teaching here, I used to teach at Spelman College, and as an advisor, one of the things we always do, they are logic wired. And students actually, when they take logic, the next thing they do is run to their math class, because it gives them the tool to go into their math class. So even people who have math phobia, at least when we try to make sure that they get a grip on this, the basis for math itself, it makes it relatively easier for them. And the math department was actually encouraging that, sending their students to us. So go to philosophy, go and do this, go, you take the next step. So I hope that someday in the future would actually come to that point at MTSU and say, look, because it is a tool, it makes no difference. I mean, when you're talking about critical thinking, whether you're in journalism or criminal justice or history or whatever discipline it is, that is a tool you do need, or even in science. Because mm-hmm. I remember as an undergraduate student, when I took logic, it was logic and scientific methods. That's the name of it. So mm-hmm. it makes no difference. And that particular course was geared toward students in natural sciences, pure science as it was called, social sciences, and humanities. So all of them were taking logic and scientific methods. So
even if you are in the humanities, I'm a political science major, you have to write term papers in which you have to not only posit a theory in your lead paragraph, but you have to back it up with citations from various reference materials in order to prove your point of view, or at least argue it successfully. Whether the professor ends up agreeing with you or not is irrelevant. It's the degree to which you are able to successfully argue the point.
Precisely.
That is what matters. And if you're going to be a doctoral student and going for a PhD, someday you're going to have to stand and deliver
right.
that dissertation. And if you don't have your ducks in a row,
that's it. Well, you're absolutely right. That's precisely the nature of evidence. You make a claim, what evidence do you you have to back up this claim? And so whether it be in literature or not, I mean, that's why they say, what's the textual evidence for this proposition you're offering? And you have to be able to look at what kind of pertinent evidence is there to support this claim. So you're absolutely right. That's why this course that I've developed, even though it's a 4800 for the timing, it's a 4800, I haven't decided if I'm going to make it a full-fledged, it is going to be an upper-level course. But I do not just want to limit it to philosophy students. I won't be open to people in political science, in history, in criminal justice, in any of these other disciplines, because one of the things about philosophy, there's been a misperception of philosophy that people are philosophers, they live in the clouds, basically. But what is not, what people are unaware of is, in fact, the extent to which philosophy actually supports a good many other disciplines out there. And in the sense that we provide them with the tools that will enable students by the, to function well in their own disciplines. And it is not a, it's not by accident. I suppose we have not been trying to market ourselves in our own horn, but but we know what we are doing, and we are of vital importance to the academy, and that kind of state.
Well, philosophical arguments have impacted the course of American history. Big government versus small government, an argument that is still going on today. Mm-hmm. States' rights versus national federalism.
Yes.
These are things that can be debated from philosophical points of view.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the one goes all the way back even to Thomas Jefferson, actually, was a philosopher, because you think about his writings, basically in Laws, for example, look mm-hmm. at how he was really worried about what kind of a society the United States should like. I mean, when you begin to do this, you're not just saying, well, you're not just fabricating things, you're conceptualizing, you're looking beyond what is the case mm-hmm. and how to fashion a good society. As Bertrand Russell would put it, even if our material needs were met, they would still have these big questions, these big philosophical questions. What is the good life? What is happy life? What is happiness in itself?
Yeah.
Why should I care about my fellow human beings? These are large mm-hmm. questions, seem mundane. It's ironic because we seem to be preoccupied with trying to get this, etc., etc. But one of the things I always tell my students, I say, look at somebody like Bill Gates. I can imagine when he was in his 20s, he was so concerned about making money and making a software and getting so and so and so. But at the end, now he's got it all. What do you think he's doing? Now he's thinking beyond making money. He's thinking, how can I help the world? How can I help people in, say, Nigeria or someplace out there who are afflicted with this kind of thing? In other words, our humanity actually begins to shine forth, as it were. We begin to concern ourselves with human condition. And that's precisely what philosophy actually leads us to.
I got into a discussion with Dr. Angela Mertig from the sociology department. She's teaching a course this summer called Animals and Society, and it's mm-hmm. all about how our relationship as human beings with animals, both wild and domesticated, how we view them. Do we anthropomorphize them by giving them names like Max and Sally and various and sundry things? But one of the things we got into is the fact that, that human beings are animals, and we very seldom acknowledge that. We're warm-blooded vertebrate mm-hmm. mammals. Most of us are vertebrate. We won't talk about politicians, but most of us are warm-blooded mammals. We are animals. And when we talk about animals, four-footed and otherwise, we humans, we talk about their instincts. They do something on the basis of their instincts.
Right.
Well, we're animals too. So when people talk about going on their instincts or going on, you know, quote-unquote woman's intuition, it's often marginalized, put down, disparaged. That kind of knowledge, that kind of evidence, that kind of justification is just dismissed as some flight of fancy or some kind of fiction. Why is it unreasonable to discount the human animal's instinct as a kind of knowledge and justification in the world?
Well, that's a very difficult question. I say it's difficult because, on the one hand, one of the reasons why instinct is marginalized or discounted is that some people would say, well, know something to be the case, then you have to have good reasons for making the kind of claim that you're making, namely, I know that so and so, you have to have reasons. And moreover, it is said that, well, the belief-forming process is one that you should be aware of. Things should not just simply pop into your head. And if there is no rationale for these things popping into your head, even if they are true, it would appear as if you have no grounds for claiming that they are true. So that's why people actually say, well, let's discount instincts. On On the other hand, when people talk about women's intuition, that is a very significant, I think, and I've heard about that and I've looked at various programs where people talk about women's intuition as a credible source of information. Now, from the point of view of a man, I don't know, I cannot have that. But I would not discount that because if it is consistently true, that is when people talk about women's intuition, how it enables them to figure out some things which a man cannot figure out, then we've got to be able to accept the fact that there is something about a woman which equips her to solve certain kinds of problems, to be aware of certain kinds of things, to form certain kinds of beliefs, which by virtue of the fact that I'm a man, I don't have. And we cannot just discount it, especially since there is overwhelming evidence that when women say these things, these make these claims, they are true. And there's some kind of a consistency there, so I don't want to discount it. It is what I would say, I don't know how it works, but I'm not going to dispute the fact that it does work. Mm-hmm. Pragmatically speaking, there is evidence to say that it does work. Many times women have said, you know, I suspected, something told me that he was cheating and I found out. You see, I mean, if there's so much consistency there, and which is called women's intuition, tells me that this is not right, and they're able to say, yeah, I figured it out and I got the evidence, mm-hmm. I'm not going to dispute that.
There's something that cause, and I don't totally understand it either, but there's something that would cause a woman to sit bolt upright in the middle of the bed at 3 o'clock in the morning with fear that something has happened to her offspring on the other side of the world, maybe in a war situation or something like that, without any empirical knowledge of the fact. And then she comes to find out later through the DOD that her son has been wounded or has been killed in a war. That boy was part of her body for 9 months, and there's a symbiotic relationship there that can't be denied.
That's a very tough one. I don't know how to explain that, and it does occur, and some would say, well, it doesn't fit into the propositional account of knowledge that we're given. But again, we're assuming that only propositional account of knowledge is knowledge. And what you're saying, in effect, is that we've got to be able to acknowledge some forms or basis of knowledge which we just cannot explain. And it's as if I was thinking about, take for example, kids who are, although this might be the competent sense of knowledge, kids who are autistic. I mean, you have some cases of autism and the kid cannot just function ordinarily speaking. But, and I've seen some of these on news or news magazine programs, these kids, you give them any numbers, they can actually calculate very complex mathematical problems. You give them any numbers, add, I don't know, whatever it is. You and I would need to go and look up to get our calculator and then try to add it up. But the kid just spews out the number on a very consistent basis like that. And this is a kid who cannot function otherwise. So how does he or she do it? I don't know, but it's happening right in front of us. So we've got to be able to say, maybe there are some things about the brain, about autism, that we do not know how indeed autism leads these kids actually to be able to do these kinds of things. They are competent at doing it because it's not by accident. As often as you give them these numbers, they keep giving you the right answer, but they themselves cannot explain what's going on. So is it possible for people to know things, but we cannot describe how they know these things? Of course, this would be the competent sense. They are competent in giving those the piece of information.
There's another kind of evidence that might not pass muster in a debate or in a courtroom, and that's the kind of evidence that we obtain through nuances in body language and the tone of a person's voice. For example, an African-American goes into a store to buy something, and the way that the person behind the counter treats him very coldly, by comparison to how white people in the store are treated, even though he gives them back the correct change and there's nothing phony about the business transaction itself, tells him that, you know, you ain't welcome here, boy, without actually saying you ain't welcome here, boy.
Yes.
And some white people will say, well, the guy's just paranoid, he's overly sensitive. Well, not necessarily. You can't really put yourself in this guy's shoes.
Right. That is absolutely true. And that's unfortunate because sometimes when people say these things, and African Americans would say, well, this was how I was treated, and they complain about it, the dominant group, the society at large, would say, no, it's in your imagination. But it is not. There are some things, you know, you cannot put your finger on them. You cannot describe them, but you know when they are happening to you. And sometimes when I teach, I say, you know, my students, I always intersect things like this with gender concerns. For example, I say, look, as a male working across campus at night, I am not worried about about being jumped or being raped. Mm-hmm. I would worry about being held up at gunpoint or something of the sort. So it's a form of violence. But a female walking across campus has double concerns, has a concern of being violated that way and also being violated as a rape victim. So if a woman actually expresses that kind of a concern, you cannot just say, oh, it's in your head, this place is safe. That is real, because these things do happen. The reality of her concern cannot be dismissed. You cannot discount. So if it is true that these things do happen, it means that that concern is a legitimate concern. Equally, when coming back to your issue, when somebody says, well, no, this was how I was received, regardless of how everybody else might be looking at it, is I know it when I see it. I know it. I experience it. You cannot put your finger at it, but I think people have to take that very, very seriously, because we're not just paranoid people walking around any more than a woman walking at night is just plain paranoid, because there are realities out there which she has to confront, and there is that anxiety even before stepping out of her office or stepping out of her house, you see, which I don't have. I have other kinds of concerns. So equally, when you go to a store, there is some kind of an anxiety, how am I going to be received, which a white person will not have. And I think that's the kind of thing that some time back, Peggy McIntosh, maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago, she was here doing a workshop, and I've read a lot of Peggy McIntosh's stuff. That's the kind of thing when she's talking about how indeed what she calls white privilege and the knapsack of and privilege, the kinds of assumptions that people make, and she doesn't have to worry about, white people don't have to worry about this, but these are real. And she came to addressing this, encountering this, becoming aware of these kinds of white privilege when she went in investigating gender issues, because as she was dealing with gender issues, the assumptions that males make in society, women have this uphill task. Then he don't know, now wait a minute, now this is just one dimension. I can just imagine what people of color are going through. And then she digressed a little bit and said, okay, well, let's look at it from this point of view. Now I see exactly how I am benefiting from white privilege, you see, but without my being aware of it. So right. If somebody were to prior to this point come to me and tell me that this is happening, she might not have believed it, but now she began to see it very clearly, as it were. So
we understand that certain groups are oppressed, but we don't look at the flip side of the coin and say that we have certain privileges, certain groups in society have certain privileges, because we experience those privileges every day and take them for granted and just consider them pro forma, a part of our everyday lives. We don't look at them as privileges.
Exactly. Until actually one does some kind of an introspection, then we'll see that there are certain assumptions which are guiding us actually, and we don't even think about them. Mm-hmm. And of course, for every oppressed group, there is a dominant group, there is an oppressor group, and the individual may not be oppressor per se, but to the extent that he or she is a beneficiary of the kind of a social structure within which her entire life is implicated, then of course it means that that awareness we're talking about, when people become aware of it, they say, I didn't in fact know that, I thought maybe everything was just fine and dandy. Well, fine and dandy because you're not on the receiving end of
all the crap.
That's right.
That's a technical term, crap.
That's right, it is.
The class is called Knowledge, Evidence, and Justification, Philosophy 4800. It's a brand new course for fall 2010, being taught by Dr. Clarence Johnson. And if you take it, you will think about not what knowledge is, what truth is, how you justify your position, what sorts of evidence you use to justify your position, and how you know what you know and how you know what you don't know.
That's right. Thank you. That's good.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. Johnson.
My pleasure.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can download the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.